It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickards.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about a victim of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, who is also a mathematical genius who transformed the Internet.
But first, we're talking about a report out today from a bipartisan commission saying our national defense oversight needs to be streamlined.
We're talking with one of the co-chairs of the 9/11 Commission about how our national security has changed since the 2001 attacks and in what ways we might still need to change.
Our guest is Lee Hamilton, director of the Center on Congress at Indiana University. He was vice chair of the 9/11 Commission and a former U.S. representative from Indiana. Lee, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
What have you been thinking about today? It's September 11th, an anniversary of, obviously, that horrible day in 2001. You chaired the 9/11 Commission. What's been on your mind today?
I think uppermost on my mind is the victims and the family of the victims. During the 9/11 Commission report operations, we met frequently with those people. I think, by and large, the families of the victims have responded constructively from that horrible tragedy, and I got to know many of them well. I've been thinking a lot about them today.
And you've been calling for some changes in the way that we are handling the way the U.S. is prepared for a future terrorist attack. What do you think needs to change?
Most of our recommendations of the 9/11 Commission were adopted either in whole or in part. One that was clearly not adopted was our recommendation as to how the Congress should oversee the Homeland Security efforts. Congress has really got a very large number of overlapping committees and subcommittees that oversee the Department of Homeland Security, and when you have that many, you really don't have much oversight at all. We think the American people would be safer and more secure if the Congress were to robustly exercise its oversight responsibility with respect to Homeland Security activities.
How do we streamline something like that? What would need to change?
Well, it's not all that complicated. Congress needs to treat the Department of Homeland Security very much as it does the Department of Justice and the Departments of Defense. Each one of those departments of government report not exclusively, but primarily to one committee. And that committee, Armed Services Committee, for example, has primary oversight responsibility for the activities of the department. You need the same thing. Congress simply needs to follow its current examples with regard to Homeland Security to improve the oversight.
Now, there's been a couple examples of how the fact that this hasn't been streamlined has affected us. A couple examples in the New York Times piece that we mentioned were the threat of cyber attacks and also bioterrorism. What's been happening there in those areas?
Well, the Congress deference to the president, the Congress inability to act in those areas, very important areas of national security, means that the president has to act. And the president acts with an executive order, which doesn't have the reach or force of legislation. So Congress's timidity here, its passivity, its failure to exercise its responsibilities, just hands the power to the president. And the president's power grows, the congressional power diminishes as they defer action. I'd like to see, of course, the Congress step up to what I consider its constitutional responsibilities and be a partner with the president in passing such things as legislation on cybersecurity and other important acts of national security.
Now, one of the issues that you have with the way things are set up right now is that it's expensive and that, you know, we're spending a lot of money answering questions instead of, you know, taking care of business. Can you explain that a little?
Well, when you've got 100 committees or more looking and subcommittees claiming jurisdiction over some part of the Homeland Security Department, you have a very wasteful system, very extravagant system. What happens is that Homeland Security people have to take part in We estimate almost 300 formal House and Senate hearings over a period of time. In 2009, the Homeland Security people did the equivalent of 66 work years responding to questions from Congress. Every Secretary of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, Michael Chertoff, Janet Napolitano, who's just leaving, have complained vigorously that they're just spending too much time responding to congressional questions and requests and requirements. They're spending more time on that than they are executing their responsibilities for Homeland Security. That's an absurd situation. It diverts us from the real task at hand. Can't correct it quickly, probably, but we need to correct it so that you get a more focused oversight of Homeland Security. And the Homeland Security folks are reporting to one committee or at least several committees and not 100.
Well, as you know, the U.S. government is not exactly known for being lean and fast-moving. How would you explain to the American people and to Congress itself exactly what is at stake?
Well, I think the Congress has to understand and the American people have to understand that this business of congressional oversight makes a lot of difference. Congress has two responsibilities, legislation, everybody knows about that, but oversight is terribly important. Oversight ought to be looking into every nook and cranny of the activities of Homeland Security. They ought to make sure the laws are being implemented, that money is being spent in a reasonable, honest way, that you don't have any hanky-panky going on, and that suggestions are made by Congress to improve the operations of Homeland Security, to criticize it, to support it when they're doing something right. Good, strong congressional oversight can greatly strengthen and unify the work of a department. It's present elsewhere. It's not present in this department. It's a correction that has to be made by the Congress, and they ought to get to it.
Well, as you know, Congress is dealing with a lot of stuff right now. We've got Syria, the economy, a looming battle over the budget. How do you call attention to fixing the process when there's so much other stuff that's important, too, on the table?
Well, Congress always has a long list of priorities, and you do what's important. I consider the safety and security of the American people important. I consider no task greater than that that the Congress considers. And I believe what we're suggesting here, you refer to it as process, and that's correct, of course. But getting the process right means you get the result right more often than not. So let's get the process right. Sure, it has other priorities. They're all important. But that's the business of the Congress. They've got to sort through these priorities. Got to make more progress than they are on all of them. Surely they have to make progress on this one, because directly at stake here is the safety and security of the American people. What other function do they have more important than that?
Well, I thank you so much for being with us today to talk about it.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
We've been talking to Lee Hamilton, director of the Center on Congress at Indiana University. He was vice chair of the 9/11 Commission.
Coming up next, a look at the man who may have been the first victim of the September 11th attacks, a math genius who transformed the Internet. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Almost 3,000 people died on the morning of September 11th, 2001. One man, though, Danny Lewin, was almost certainly the first victim of those attacks.
He was on board American Airlines Flight 11 and was reportedly stabbed to death while trying to stop the terrorists from taking control of his plane before it hit the first tower of the World Trade Center.
Danny isn't only remarkable because of his actions on September 11th, 2001. He was also a mathematical genius who created a billion-dollar tech company, which ironically proved critical for communications in the days after the attacks.
Reporter and author Molly Knight Raskin is here with us now to talk about the life of Danny Lewin. His book is called No Better Time, The Brief, Remarkable Life of Danny Lewin, The Genius Who Transformed the Internet. Molly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's such a remarkable story. What got your interest in telling Danny's story?
Well, I first heard about Danny around the 10th anniversary of 9/11. A friend of a friend told me some fragments of his story, and as a freelance journalist, somebody asked me to produce a short documentary tribute video to him for the 10th anniversary. And at that time, I just thought, I heard all these various disparate pieces of his life, his actions on 9/11, but more so the way he lived and what he created. And I thought to myself, why don't more people know this story? And from there, I just became determined to tell it in full.
Well, let's begin on the last day of his life. Why do we understand that he was the first victim of the attacks?
Well, what we know from the facts as gathered by the 9/11 Commission is that the passenger on that flight in seat 9B in business class, which was Danny's seat, was stabbed by one of the terrorists who was seated behind him. We know there was some kind of a struggle that concluded in that stabbing. Beyond that, the facts are scanty, really. And so I do use the word almost certainly the first victim, because we'll never know for sure exactly what happened on that flight. But what I did with the book was take the evidence from the 9/11 Commission and combine that with two facts about Danny, one of which was that he served in the most elite counterterrorism unit of the Israeli army and was trained to hunt and kill terrorists. And the second part was interviews with more than 100 people who knew them, who said he would have never, ever gone down without a fight.
And that's something that struck me reading your book, is that everybody you talked to said, yeah, that sounds like Danny.
Yeah, he was someone who really relished in competition and relished in arguing and was rather combative and also physically extremely strong. Again, a trained warrior in this elite unit. And so there's really no doubt in my mind, after interviewing so many people, even people who served with him in the army in Israel, that once he had some inkling of the terrible thing that was about to happen on that flight, that he made a plan to do something and he jumped into action.
And let's talk about one of the other remarkable parts of his life. What did Danny Lewin do for the internet?
It's really a remarkable story of what he did in his life. I mean, he died at age 31, in those few years before his death, he wrote a set of algorithms for his master's thesis at MIT, and he used these to transform the internet with a company he co-founded with one of his professors called Akamai Technologies. And it's not a well-known name today like any of the big giants in computing, but the company he created made the internet a better, faster, functioning internet. And at the time when he invented these algorithms, the internet was moving very slowly and crashing a lot because of congestion. And he developed something that made it faster and better and turned it into a multi-billion-dollar company in his late 20s.
Let's talk a little bit more. We don't need to get too technically detailed, but as you described, and I remember those days, if more than 20 people, it seemed like, went to the same website at the same time, it got very, very slow. How did he tackle that problem?
He tackled the problem using complex theoretical math. And so basically what he did was write this set of algorithms and used those to create a sort of a magic layer, they call it, on top of the internet. So Akamai itself set servers up around the world and then programmed these servers with their intelligent software. And that intelligent software was and still is able to route content and data through channels of the internet that are not congested. And so it basically was like a FedEx of the internet. And the underpinnings of that technology programmed into those servers came out of Danny's master's thesis.
And you describe Lewin and others as well as a mathematical genius. Where did that come from? Did you get a sense from him growing up, from his life, why this mathematical genius developed?
Definitely. I mean, he understood math at a level that is so complex that, you know, there have been those who have written extensively about it and argued that it is innate. And there's no doubt but that Danny's family, his parents were both extremely intelligent. They were doctors. They fostered in all of their kids an enthusiasm for intellectual curiosity, for math and science, for learning about computers when just the first PCs had come out. And so he was not only innately gifted, but he was brought up that way. And then that gift really came into view when he attended graduate school, first in Israel and then at MIT. And even then, when he was at the two top schools for science and engineering in the world, those around him said, this is one of the smartest guys I've ever met.
In talking to people about his career, do you get a sense of the lost potential of what he would have done if he hadn't died in the September 11th attack?
Definitely. I think that's the question that, to this day, haunts everybody who knew him well. He died so young, and he accomplished so much before his death that it's hard not to wonder what he could have accomplished. And, you know, he wasn't a household name, but he created something that most of us use every day when we log on to the internet for things like Facebook or iTunes. And it's the magic that keeps the internet up and running. And it's something that he would have probably taken and built on for the rest of his life. He was someone who never slowed down. And so there's also no doubt in my mind he would have done great things had he lived beyond such a young age.
Would he be a household name, do you think, like the late Steve Jobs, say, or Bill Gates?
I think so. You know, I think so personally, but I also interviewed a lot of people in technology and business who are giants themselves, co-founder of Yahoo, founder of Ticketmaster, and all of them believed that he would have been. And so I think that there's good indication from what I think his trajectory would have been that we would have known him as a household name.
How ubiquitous on the internet are the things, the algorithms he created? Is it something that everybody uses, or at least uses something inspired by what he did?
Oh, sure. I mean, Akamai now is a huge company. It's a multi-billion dollar worldwide company, and at any moment they control or work with 30% of the internet traffic around the world. And again, a lot of these giants, these names and technology that we all take, you know, sometimes take for granted, their speed and efficiency, and they run on Akamai. They run on Akamai servers. So we do use that technology every day, and it's got this lasting impact that is pretty extraordinary. It hasn't changed much. And sure, now today there are competitors and there are people who do similar things, but Akamai has sustained itself throughout many years of economic upswings and downswings and still managed to stay afloat and be successful. And if you ask people there, a lot of them will say it's because of Danny.
You talked to a lot of people who knew him professionally and personally. What was he like as a person?
Well, the thing that really attracted me to writing about him, writing a book about him, is that he, despite the fact that on paper, you know, it just looked like everything he touched turned to gold. I mean, it was almost, you know, when I approached this, it was like writing about someone who was superhuman. This guy was so brilliant. He was so physically agile. He was so gifted. He became such a keen businessman. He had a quick wit. He was a nice guy. But he was also really complex, and that's why I really enjoyed writing about him. I think he was someone who this sort of speaks to the title of the book. He really never wanted to waste 1 minute. And even at such a young age, he was just squeezing the life out of every second of every minute of every hour of every day. And I found that really fascinating, just what that kind of drive and where it comes from and how he got it, which is really what I try and get to in the book. And it was really inspiring to me to write about somebody like that. And, you know, maybe that was also, you know, it has its downsides too, which is that he didn't get to spend as much time with family or friends or enjoying this great wealth that he accumulated so quickly.
In our last minute, ironically, I guess one of the greatest tests of the things he created to help prevent the internet being congested was the September 11th attack that he died in. How did the internet, how did the people using his technology do with the massive surge of people going online to see what the heck was going on?
Yeah, well, it's the really tragic irony of the story is that, you know, all along for the years that he created Akamai, Danny predicted that someday the internet would see some crush of traffic that the system just couldn't handle and that Akamai would be there to help manage it. And September 11th really proved everything that he said to be true, which was, you know, it proved the 100-year flood equivalent on the web of disasters. And at the same time, Akamai was there to help a lot of really critical websites that people were using to get information stay live that day and not crash. And it was because of Danny's technology that they were able to do that.
Molly, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That was Molly Knight Raskin. She's a reporter. Her new book is No Better Time, The Brief Remarkable Life of Danny Lewin, the Genius Who Transformed the Internet. That book just came out today.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll speak with an African-American journalist who returned to his college alma mater to find out why so many students like him never graduate.
We'll also talk about why voting and eating may be more related than you thought. A public health expert who studies food and food politics will give us a lowdown on the political world of the food industry.
And we'll continue our Curious Wisconsin series tomorrow. We're going to take a look at Ripon's Mystery Cave.
That and a lot more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, it's this week's installment of Wisconsin Life, and we'll pay a visit to Bayfield. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There's been a dramatic increase in severe disabling mental illness in the United States in the last 20 years or so.
Some experts, including our next guest, say the increase is due to overdiagnosis and the side effects of psychiatric drugs.
But another theory out there is that mental illness is a form of rebellion against our society.
Well, why do you think there's been an increase in mental illness in the United States, things like anxiety and depression? And have you suffered from those conditions? Call in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 and share your experiences. Our guest is Bruce Levine, a practicing psychologist, author, and public speaker on how society, culture, and politics intersect. Bruce, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be on.
Well, according to what we've learned, there's been a sharp spike in mental illness diagnoses in the United States. Can you give us a sense of how big an increase we've seen?
Well, a couple of ways of looking at it. One is just taking a look at the disability rate, psychiatric disability as measured by Social Security disability insurance and supplemental Social Security. And what we've got is about a 2.5-fold increase between 1987 and 2007. So, for example, we went from 1 in 184 Americans in 1987 diagnosed with some kind of serious mental illness, serious enough to be on disability, to now 1 in 76. And that increase is even higher. It's a 35-fold increase among children who are labeled with a serious enough disability so their parents can receive payment. You can also see it in terms of how much the medication has gone through the roof. So you've got a 400% increase in antidepressants over the last 20 years. Women right now between the ages of 40 and 59, 23% are on just one kind of psychiatric drug, antidepressants. And whether it's diagnoses or drug treatment, you see huge increases in the last 20, 30 years.
Now, you talked about children, and that's a sea change, right? It used to be normally adults were the ones who were diagnosed with this. What kind of age range are we talking about?
We're talking about nowadays it's common to diagnose kids with bipolar disorder, which is a serious disorder, pediatric bipolar disorder, which was never diagnosed with 3- and 4-year-olds. It was used to be considered ridiculous. If you took a look at the symptoms of it, the symptoms seemed to be like what 2- and 3-year-olds do, very moody and have grandiose ideas. But now, because of a lot of reasons having to do with the pharmaceutical companies having a lot of influence and power over psychiatry, it became common. And so you had, from 30 years ago, you'd never see kids, almost never see kids diagnosed with pediatric bipolar disorder. And it went from '94 to 2003, a 10-year period, you saw a 40-fold increase in that.
Now, what do you put all this down to? I mean, is it simply the fact that, well, we didn't used to diagnose this stuff, and now we're just more on top of our game in terms of diagnosis?
I think there are three major reasons. One was considered 20 years ago a radical idea. It was sort of radical extremist anti-psychiatrist. You were supposed to be one of those if you had this idea. Now it's very mainstream. In fact, it's an idea that's being talked about by people in establishment psychiatry who were part of the creation of the DSM-4. DSM is the Psychiatric Diagnostic Bible published by the American Psychiatric Association. And this first idea is the normal is is the pathologizing of very normal behaviors. So, for example, shyness has become pathologized, a rebellion has become medicalized, diseased. And increasingly, what sort of broke the, it was the straw that broke the camel's back for a lot of establishment psychiatrists, including a guy named Alan Francis, who is chairman of the DSM-IV task force, was grief being pathologized. So, in the old diagnostic Bibles, that people were not considered to have an illness of depression if they were grieving for a significant period of time after the loss of a loved one. And now that grief period, it's like you've only got now a couple of weeks. You could be the most important person in your life, but if you're still depressed and after the loss of such a person, boom, you're labeled with a depression, and boom, you're on antidepressants. So that kind of pathologizing of normal behaviors, that's one major reason.
And what about the others?
Well, the other reason is becoming increasingly accepted by establishment psychiatry. Again, it was for a long period of time viewed as radical and extremist. But through the work, mainly through really the investigative journalist, a guy named Robert Whitaker, has brought to light that the idea that if you take a look at a lot of problems, behavioral problems, that really were just kind of mild or moderate and very episodic through the use of medications, and they became chronic, severe, and disabling. So a concrete example of this would be kids not paying attention in school, paying attention everywhere else, really not causing a lot of problems out there except underachieving in school and then being diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and almost all of these kids being put on some kind of a psychostimulant, amphetamines really, Adderall, Vyvanse, these are amphetamines. And for a certain percentage of these kids, drug companies say a low percentage, maybe 2 or 3%. Other folks say as high as 10%. They will get manic reactions. They'll move into mania. So when you're diagnosing that many kids with ADHD and giving that many kids the Ritalin, Adderall, Vyvanse, these speed really like drugs, you're going to have a certain percentage of them that move into mania, which is and they become diagnosed with a bipolar disorder. So those are two of the reasons that have gone from being viewed as extreme and anti-psychiatry to really now being more and more mainstream. But there's a third reason that I talk about in that article that has to do with culture and society.
Yeah, and tell us about that one, because this is sort of the most, stunning one of all of these reasons. Tell us about what you think is causing it from society's point of view.
Well, if you take a look at American culture, and you can see this from a lot of different ways, that clearly, not just the United States, but a lot of high-income nations, they have, according to the World Health Organization, greater amounts of mental illness. If you take a look at, just take one disorder, postpartum depression, so the depression that women feel after giving birth. Well, in the United States, and also too in Great Britain, United Kingdom, there's like 10 to 20% of women who, after childbirth, move into postpartum depression. If you take a look at that same kind of thing in other cultures, for example, in Fiji, African populations, there's almost no postpartum depression. So you could go through, and then there's another study that was done in 1998 by a guy named William Vega about Mexican immigrants coming over to the United States. And if you took a look when they first arrived in America versus being here for several years, there's huge increases in rates of mental illness, huge increases in depression. So this is a fact, a reality. Now, people have different explanations for what's going on in American culture and American society that is creating this increasing amounts of mental disorders here.
It sounds like you're saying it's us.
Yeah, I mean, there's something that you give away. I guess a lot of what I talk about is there's a kind of myth of progress that certainly those folks, for example, who came over here, Mexican immigrants, they came over here to advance themselves materially, to get more money. I mean, that's a big reason why anybody comes over here to America. But there's a cost. And the author of that article, Vega, after talking to a lot of these folks, his attribution was that a lot of the increases in substance abuse, depression, other kinds of mental illness had to do with a loss of social support, that in Mexico they might have been poor, but there was a lot of social support. And once that folks came over here, they lost a lot of that. But there are other explanations, too, for why American society, Western society in general, increases the amounts of mental disorder.
We're talking right now about how society contributes to the rise of mental illness in the United States. And our guest is Bruce Levine, and we've linked his article on Salon on the Central Time Facebook page.
We want to hear from you. Why do you think this is happening? Why do you think more of us are being diagnosed with depression, with anxiety, and other disorders? Do you agree with what he's saying? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or send an email. talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking now with Bruce Levine, a practicing psychologist and author, and we're talking about why there has been such a spike in diagnosed mental illness in the United States. And our guest says it's due to a combination of factors, one of which is that society just isn't supporting us in the right ways anymore.
You can join the show. What do you think of that idea? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can always post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's go to the calls, the phones right now, and take Casey in Milwaukee. Hi, Casey.
Hi. I'm really excited. This is the first time I've ever been on the show.
Oh, so, welcome.
I think this is a This is a really wonderful topic. I think your guest brought up so many valid points. I think that we are certainly over-diagnosing people, I think, you know, especially with things like ADD. You know, I think young children are supposed to be hyper. I think it's unnatural to expect young children to sit still for extended periods of time. But we do like to pathologize everything now. I think it's partially because of, you know, this super money-obsessed culture that we have. And, you know, if the drug companies can make a buck, they will. I also think it's a result of, I do think that there is more depression and anxiety problems than there used to be. And I think that has to do with the fact that we're such a hyper-competitive culture. I think, you know, our identities are so reliant upon, you know, our careers and how much money we make. And, you know, we're such an individualistic society. I mean, just, you know, look at South Korea. They have the highest rate of suicide in the world, and they have the longest work days, and they're extremely competitive in South Korea. I think, you know, the more your self-esteem is reliant upon your achievements and your career, I think the more likely you are to have problems like depression and anxiety. And, you know, being such an individualistic culture, we don't have very strong family values anymore. We're not a communal type culture where we really support each other and where we have a group identity. We're very individualistic, so I think that can cause us to feel lonely, and it can cause us to feel a lot of pressure.
All right. Well, thank you so much for all those thoughts, Casey, and a lot to go off there. What do you think about all of those things, Bruce?
Well, Casey's right on. I mean, if you take a look at really what's associated with something like depression, it has nothing to do with biochemical brain imbalances. By the way, the National Institute of Mental Health rejected this idea that depression was associated with the underproduction of serotonin. You still hear these commercials, but it's just not true. I mean, if you take a look at what depression is associated with, it's associated with overwhelming pain. It's associated with high unemployment. It's associated with being on public assistance. It's associated with having great losses in your life, financial, physical losses. This is it. So when you think about, when you really want to think about it, get back to common sense, what are the factors in culture and society that create more emotional pain, overwhelming emotional pain, and what are those factors that mitigate it, one of them being social support? And so that's the way I think people need to start looking at these things again. One of the real unfortunate things that happened when pharmaceutical companies really gained a lot of influence over psychiatry through the big money and is not only people being overdiagnosed and overmedicated, was that people forgot about a lot of these, stopped talking about it. And psychiatry too, and psychologists too, they stopped talking about these social cultural factors that create more overwhelming pain and reduce those things in society and cultures that can help mitigate it.
Well, thanks so much for that first time call, Casey. And Bruce, how much does a psychiatrist care about the DSM-4? I mean, if someone comes in and says, "Hey, doc, I'm shy," you know, the doctor can say, you know, that's normal, or they can try to prescribe some kind of social anxiety medicine. Do you think that psychiatrists are over-relying on that?
Well, the DSM right now, they're up to the DSM-5. That's the thing that they've used for insurance purposes. You can't get a insurance reimbursements, third-party payments, without having some kind of DSM diagnosis. So it's pretty important for a lot of legal and financial reasons. Nowadays, there's a huge difference between psychiatry now and 30, 40 years ago. 30, 40 years ago, financially, you could do okay talking to people and trying to figure out what the sources of these overwhelming pains in their life were and try to help do some problem solving to, if possible, either A, get rid of it, or if not possible, at least validate people's emotional pain and make them feel that they weren't crazy for having these symptoms. Nowadays, yeah, there was a New York Times piece on this a few years ago, that the vast majority of psychiatrists, just all they do is something called medication management, which is they just check symptoms and they change medications. And they spend no time at all trying to understand what are these sources of overwhelming pain in people's life. If they did, it would be obvious that lack of social support, feeling coerced, huge amounts of resentment, unemployment, all of these obvious things, which anybody, if you spent an hour with any of the people who walk in my office who are feeling depressed, you don't need a PhD or an MD to figure it out.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Another call. Laura is with us now in Green Bay. Hey, Laura.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that historically it has been shameful to be mentally ill, and to some degree it's still quite shameful. And I heard this statement by one of the guests on NPR some time ago, that when insurance will cover mental illness to the same degree it covers physical illness, then people will not feel it shameful, and a lot of this will take care of itself. I bet everyone who is listening to this knows someone who was obviously mentally ill, never went to a psychiatrist, was never medicated, and just lived in pain most of their lives because they were too ashamed to seek help.
All right. Thank you, Laura. What do you think, Bruce?
Well, this whole issue of a stigma of mental illness is a real fascinating one that I've done a lot of research on. And one of the things that a lot of the establishment kind of psychiatry organizations from the American Psychiatric Association, which is the group, the professional psychiatrists who publishes the DSM to consumer groups like the National Alliance of Mentally Ill, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, which, by the way, all of these groups take money from drug companies. One of the things that they came to was this idea that if we can, even though they knew, and they admitted this, we don't really have these biochemical correlates to these mental illnesses like depression. There is no science on excessive amount of neurotransmitters causing psychoses or not enough neurotransmitters like serotonin causing depression. But it's important that we get people to believe that these things are diseases, just like cancer and all that. Therefore, the theory was that this would get rid of the stigma of mental illness, because then it would have parity to these other illnesses. Unfortunately, in practice, that didn't happen. That didn't really work out. So what happened was that there was really more of a stigma. If you take a look at the research, where people are, if they're feeling that they have something that's caused by psychosocial issues, about what's going on psychologically, socially, culturally, that their problems are caused by that, they themselves feel less stigmatized, and people view them as less stigmatized. As people who see, and research shows that people who view folks who are acting problematically, depressed or bizarrely, that they have some kind of biochemical disease, they actually attribute more stigma to them. They won't hang around them. So this idea of reducing social stigma by diseasing folks, by creating this kind of mental illness diseasing with parity to physical illness, it just did not work.
And Bruce, we talked about putting some of the onus on society for not supporting us. People are more isolated and traditional structures of support have broken down, like church and communities. But how much of us is just down to us? Because we're a culture now that wants things to be fixed with a pill. We want it to be that easy. I mean, it could be a chicken or the egg thing.
Right.
Maybe we didn't create that desire in ourselves. Maybe the drug companies did. But what do you say to
right.
that?
On one hand, I mean, we can all take responsibility to rebel. against it. And that's what one of my books is called, Common Sense Rebellion, as opposed to self, that's the name of the book, as opposed to what a lot of us are doing are self-destructive kind of rebellions. And yes, but I think the reality is we have been socialized, we have been through advertising, through a lot of professional organizations, to believe that you could just take a pill to get rid of your pain. And you can. I mean, for a lot of folks, there's all kinds of pills that you can detach, disconnect from your pain. You can do it with psychiatric drugs, you can do it with illegal drugs, you can do it with alcohol, and that's what people have been doing for many, many years to kind of disconnect from their pain and feel less depressed. Unfortunately, there's a downside to doing that. There's a downside in terms of obviously the adverse effects of these drugs, and you build up tolerance, you need more and more. But there's a political downside too. If everybody is just taking a pain to take the edge off, you have Brave New World. You have nobody. Everybody's just sort of decided as a group here that it's just too much. Society and culture is too horrific, too problematic.
And we're going to have to leave it there, Bruce. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Talking to Bruce Levine, author and psychologist. His piece is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, a hearing on raw milk sales in Wisconsin on Central Time on the Ideas Network.